I have three major points today. My objective is to try to get through the first point. And the other two are much quicker by comparison. So in theory, it'll all work out just fine, but never having done this one before. I'm entitling the message Micah 6:8, Justice, Mercy, and Humility. In Micah 6:8, we might turn there. You know, it was many years ago, I grew up in a Protestant church, and when the pastor gave his sermon, he had in his bulletin our scripture for today. And then they would list one scripture, and he would talk for 10 minutes, and anything beyond that, people would start to fidget. And that would be the only reference to the Bible. Nobody had a Bible or even brought one. He just referenced it, one scripture, put it in there, and that was their message, was on that one scripture today. I'm not going to quite do that the same way, but I am going to use this as a base scripture that we're going to reference in Micah 6:8, with the title of Justice, Mercy, and Humility. In Micah 6:8, and we've all heard this before, but I want to examine it in a little different depth, perhaps, than what we've done before. He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. In order to understand this verse and all that it encompasses, we must see what led up to this verse in the book of Micah. Micah was known as a minor prophet, but it's a minor prophet only because of the size of his written book, not because of the minor in the importance of his prophecies. According to the Abingdon Bible Commentary, Micah was a contemporary of other prophets, Isaiah the prophet, for example. Micah was from a rural village in the northern kingdom of Israel, whereas Isaiah was from a bigger city, Jerusalem, in the southern kingdom, which was Judah. The kings over this period of time, we read about in the books of Kings and Chronicles, they were Omri and Ahab and a series of shorter ruling kings, such as Zechariah 6 months and Shalom for 1 month and Menahem for 11 years, Pekahiah for 2 years. He was killed off by a guy named Pekah who ruled for 8 years, and then a Hoshea for 9 years. So over this period of time, there were a series of kings or rulers. And slowly, step by step, at this time period in the 8th century B.C., Israel slowly became the vassal or the underling of the neighboring country of Assyria, as Israel became weaker militarily, and they had to pay tribute or taxes to its enemy, Assyria. So it was about 750 B.C. before Christ that the prophet Amos, a different prophet, carried a message that justice was important to God. If we can turn to Amos 3:10. In Amos 3:10. And Amos was preaching and prophesying at that time, and he said in Amos 3:10, "For they know not to do right, says the Eternal, who store up violence and robbery in their palaces." In other words, even the governments that, you know, that were doing things that weren't right, not just the people, but the governments, the palaces, the ones that ruled, were violent and robbing. In Amos 4, the entire chapter, it goes through a listing of the reasons that God was unhappy with Israel, that justice, future justice was coming because those people in Israel had abandoned God's law. Well, after Amos, there was also another prophet named Hosea. And Hosea had a little different message. Amos said that justice was important. And then Hosea's message was that love was required. And the book of Hosea is a story of patience. We're not going to go through all of it. I'm only going to call up Hosea 6:6. But the story of Hosea was how he was repeatedly merciful to his wayward wife. And he preached that God desired mercy, the quality of mercy, that we should display it, that those spiritual qualities of mercy and understanding were even more important than conducting sacrifices. In other words, he was calling upon the heart to have mercy rather than just ritual sacrifice for the purpose of following that, although God said to do that. And if you stop and think about it, mercy is pretty important. If Amos or Hosea said that mercy was more important than sacrifice, and God required or commanded the sacrifices, So how much more so would he expect us to consider extending mercy? And that's in Hosea 6:6, for I desired mercy. This is God speaking through Hosea. And not sacrifice, and the meaning of a greater desire by comparison, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings. So it had to be that the knowledge of God was sought out and that people would be willing to extend mercy. So you have Amos who's preaching the importance of justice. And then you have Hosea preaching the importance of mercy. And then Isaiah, which was also a contemporary at that time, followed up by noting that God required holiness. Now, holiness is a special setting apart by God for a special reason. So you have these three other prophets other than Micah that are each calling for something. In Isaiah 35, verse 8. And Isaiah writes, and a highway shall there be, a way, and it should be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for those, the wayfaring men, though fools, shall not err or enter therein. In other words, there is a way of holiness, a way, and if you look, take a look at the word holiness, of course, it means a special setting apart and getting closer to God for a special reason or purpose. And the Isaiah's prophecy was dual. Can you hear me in the back? I'm going to have to, if I need to be louder, then just do like this for me or like this, and that'll help out. So, okay. So I just want to make sure that people can hear me. I must be speaking softly today. So much time being in the car. 6,000 miles, 13 days, 13 states, two other church areas, which, by the way, was delightful in Salem, Oregon. Went there. And saw some people who had known for many years before, and then last Sabbath was in St. Paul, Minnesota, and it was heartwarming because there were people there that I went to Spokesman's Club with in 1974, and it was, in fact, that's where I was baptized, was in that congregation those many years ago. So, and it was the first time I'd ever given an opening prayer in my own home church some umpty years later, which was an odd experience. And it's the first time that, and my brother Steve was there with his kids as well. And it's the first time and he gave the closing prayer. That was a conspiracy, I figured out, for the first time. So it was delightful. there, but oh, where, how did I wander off? Israel's prophecy, or Isaiah's prophecy, is dual. He spoke of holiness before God, that the people of Judah and Israel should seek holiness, and those who did not would not be spared from the misery to come. So this is a dual prophecy because it also speaks about the future kingdom of God. We often think of the book of Isaiah has many references to the millennium, that we must seek and follow a way of holiness in order to enter the kingdom of God. So we have these prophets preaching these things. These emphases, each one has their own emphasis. Well, about this time, about 750 B.C., the sins of the southern kingdom of Judah and the northern kingdom of Israel were both beset by the same sins, and the prophets were warning them. Well, of course, then comes along the prophet Micah, and as one commentary puts it, he denounces rulers and priests and false prophets and deplores the money-grubbing exploitation of the helpless, the dishonesty in business, and sham religion. Let's turn to Micah 3:11, where that basis of that is found in Micah 3:11. In Micah 3:11, the heads thereof judge for reward. The heads meaning the rulers for reward. In other words, they pay for money is what they were doing to judge or to effectively judge. They were taking bribes. And the priests thereof teach for hire. They were taking money and teaching what people either wanted to hear, but it says teaching for hire. In other words, charging for what they were doing. And the prophets thereof divine for money. In other words, for money, they would give you a prophecy. And yet they lean upon the Eternal and say, is not the Lord among us? No evil can come upon us. Now let's take, you know, this Micah 3:11. This is really quite profound. Is that you had the rulers, the priests, and the prophets were all in it for themselves. They were all in it, taking unto themselves and reaping to them, you know, gathering to themselves money or goods or whatever it was that translated to money. And then they were saying, well, isn't God with us? I mean, we're on the right side. So because we're doing this and God must be with us, therefore nothing bad could possibly happen. So Micah pointed out that the rulers took the bribes, and so did the priests, and so did the prophets. In fact, the entire society was not following God's ways. And all the while, those rulers, priests, and prophets were claiming that God was with them and no evil would befall them. And, of course, this, by the time this was all written down, these things were history. Okay, so while these things were being prophesied, the actual writing of this was actually applying to future generations and indeed for our day today. So let's look around in our day today. In our society, do we have rulers who gather money to themselves? Do we have politicians who when they go into office, when they come out of office, they seem to be well-heeled, financially pretty well set? Even in the state of Arkansas, where the state constitution sets the minimum pay for state legislatures at around $12,000 a year. It's written in the state constitution. They passed it a few years ago. And it's a part-time job. They meet about 90 days, 60 to 90 days every 2 years. The state constitution specifically forbids any way to get around it, such as using inflated expenses as a backdoor method of screening or secreting income into the pockets of state legislators. But guess what the average income is for part-time legislators in the state of Arkansas? It's about $36,000 a year, because they submit anywhere from $12,000 to $24,000 a year in expenses for each one for those 60 to 90 days that they're in office. But the expenses come every month, year-round. I know, because I've seen the invoices. Which is really quite, somebody took the time to scan all of them in Little Rock through the Freedom of Information Act and then put them on a website. The legislators right here in Arkansas, it's not the Northern Kingdom of Israel or the Southern Kingdom of Judah, they submit little handwritten invoices and calling it their expense report or their invoice, very generic, that says legislative services, $1,200 or $2,500 every month. That's going to the state, and it's not payable to themselves, so they justify. It's payable to their wife, or it's payable to their real estate company, or payable to whatever business that they own or they have. So those are our rulers who then pollute their integrity with that clear violation of the spirit of what was printed in the Constitution. Well, what about religious leaders? I mean, it's not just in Arkansas. It's all over. We see it in many places. What about religious leaders? Just in Micah's day, there are modern religious leaders who will soil their hands with money. Some will, and we see them on TV and we see them elsewhere, where they will take a paycheck and live on an expense account. And yet, under that auspices, subvert the very organization that's doing it, who gives them the expense account or the paycheck. Or and of course, we also see false prophets who, such as on television, they vigorously announce the exact date and the end of the coming of the world by what they call the rapture. We saw that last May. And of course, they gain millions of dollars in donations. Some people donate their life savings into supporting these kinds of false ministries. It wasn't that long ago, I had a person contact me through the church's website. And we talked for quite a while, and it came about that he had fallen trap to one of these circumstances in a particular group, and he had basically turned over all of his life's assets to them. And now he was an older fellow, and he was bereft of the ability to support himself in a way that he could have, but he fell into that trap. and he had suffered a severe financial loss. And the organization was quite willing to take his money without regard to his personal circumstances. In short, the graphic announcement or pronouncement in Micah 3:11 applies just as much today as it did to ancient Israel and Judah. Well, in carrying out his warning message to ancient Israel and ancient Judah and projecting to us, the prophet Micah, then in Micah 6:8, combines the messages of the prophet Amos, which is the message of justice, the prophet Hosea, which is love or mercy, and the prophet Isaiah, which is holiness or humility, into one succinct verse, and then that we read at the beginning in Micah 6:8. He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the eternal require of you, but to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Notice that Micah styled his statement in the form of a question, and then answered his own question, sort of like a TV game show, Jeopardy, where the answer is given in the form of a question. Unfortunately, the message from the prophets of Amos and Hosea and Isaiah and Micah were not closely followed, and the entire northern kingdom of Israel suffered. In 722 BC, the Assyrians besieged the northern capital of Samaria, and a previous king, Omri, had spent a lot of time and money fortifying the walls of Samaria. It took Assyria 3 years to breach the walls of Samaria and destroy the city. In other words, all of the things that the prophets were telling about, how they would have cleanness of teeth, meaning you're not eating anything because it's a famine, and all of the other things that were going that would happen to them, all would come were coming true. All of the curses that they reaped to themselves by the Assyrians battling them and taking them over. And we can only imagine the horror that became of those people behind those those thick walls. In just 30 years, from 752 BC to 722 BC, the powerful northern kingdom of Israel ceased to exist as an independent nation. It was now a captive or subservient nation. Well, now we've examined the history of Micah 6:8, the do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with God. I suppose I could sit down. I've made the point. Those are the things we need to do. But the real question remains, how then do we follow the admonishment of Micah and the other prophets? The Oklahoma comedian Will Rogers said it well, and you may have heard me quote it before, and I'll paraphrase his comment. Some people learn by reading, some people learn by observing others, and some people have to touch the electric fence for themselves. The people in the prophet Micah's time did not follow God's laws, whether they learned of God's way in written form from the scripture, or by personally observing the bad results that happened to others who failed to follow God, or because of that, they had to experience the bad results for themselves. The story of what happened to ancient Israel and then ancient Judah is written down for us. So we have the benefit of being able to read and read what happened to them and everyone since then, and observing what has happened to others. Reading through the book of Amos 4, it's 13 verses, is unsettling as to what was going to happen to those who refuse to obey God. It's not that God has to do anything to them. They will have brought that all on themselves. So these prophecies were intended then for their whole society then, as well as our whole society today. So, of course, we want to read and observe, because we don't want to touch the electric fence for ourselves. So then the operative question is, what do we do here and now today? In Ecclesiastes 7:20 ought to set the reason why we need to do something here and now today. In Ecclesiastes 7 in verse 20. Ecclesiastes 7:20, for there is not a just man upon the earth that does good and sins not. In other words, everyone is guilty of something, and we all know that, that we are all to do justly, and yet Ecclesiastes says that there isn't a just man upon the earth that does good and sins not. In other words, we're all sinners, and so we all need to apply this verse. None of us can escape the need to apply Micah 6:8. Well, the first thing that's required of us in Micah is to do justly. So then it makes sense we should learn what does it take to do justly. Just what does that entail? What does it mean to do justly? Well, we're going to answer those questions, but first we're going to look at some of the characteristics of unjust men, and then we'll take a look at some just men from the Bible and learn from their examples and some other examples from the Bible. So let's take a look at the characteristics of the unjust man. In Proverbs 29, verse 27, I'm only going to read the first half of the verse, and we'll come back to the rest of it later. In Proverbs 29, verse 27, an unjust man is an abomination to the just. In other words, he makes your life difficult. And we all have had these experiences. Perhaps you have a boss that frustrates your work schedule regarding the Sabbath or the holy days. Maybe he criticizes you or demeans you in front of others. Your religion, or makes smart remarks, or maybe a coworker makes life difficult for you, whether it's with needling remarks or with false reports. Perhaps you have a teacher, if it's at school, mocking God, and you have to sit there and take it because it's a very difficult circumstance. Perhaps there's another student. And we've all been through this, or have had children go through this, or grandchildren, where another student will tease or make an effort to frustrate or embarrass anyone who follows God's way. And then we've all run into government bureaucrats. And a government bureaucrat may be in no particular hurry to accommodate your needs. Well, you may have limited time in your lunch break, or when you have to hurry to pick up your child after school, or you're trying to get some business done before on preparation day before the Sabbath, and you've got a long list of things to do, and they're not in a hurry. They don't really care. The pay is the same for them. So what's your problem? Perhaps there's a neighbor who disrespects your property or has wild late-night parties, loud noise, loud music. Perhaps the neighbor has a nasty pet that he may think is just wonderful, but could be threatening to you or damaging to your property or to your children. I put a little note here. We have a neighbor, bless her, sweet lady named Charlotte, and she's our only neighbor. We have a First Baptist Church on one side, and we have Charlotte on the other side, and no other neighbors because we're rural, we're on the edge of town, small farm. And it was some years ago, and I worked with a fellow, and we repoed 18 trucks. We're talking huge tractor-trailer-type trucks. And we have 20 acres there, and so there was no room to park them, and I parked them all in a row along the driveway, repoed them from a place in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, had to get them there. So the trucks were all pulled in on one day. A crew came in. They needed to park them temporarily so that they could be all shuttled off to different places for selling purposes. And so we repoed the trucks and parked them all in a nice row, looked like a truck sales lot, down the driveway. And Linda got a call from dear sweet Charlotte demanding that we move the trucks. And, well, they were all parked in a nice, neat row on our property, and she said, it's blocking her view. She wanted to be able to look out of her back window of her house and see the view out in that way, and the trucks were obstructing her view. But even worse than that, they were causing her dogs to bark. And her husband, who was a truck driver, drove at night, and so he had to sleep during the daytime, and she was very upset that her dogs were barking at our trucks and keeping her husband awake. So therefore, we should move our trucks so that their dogs wouldn't bark. I'd never been chewed out for somebody else's own dog's barking before, but this is an interesting experience. Of course, it was a matter of days and the trucks were moved. But you never know what circumstance can come about and what people will be thinking. And she's been a sweet lady ever since. It must have been a bad day for her. But there could be others that are more unjust situations that are really, really much more traumatic. You hear about neighbors that get into squawks and one will cut each other's trees down, tear up fence lines, park on somebody else's lawn, any number of things. Perhaps there's another driver who blocks the traffic for you on the road. Maybe he's following too close as a tailgater. Or maybe he passes at breakneck speed and then pulls in front of you and cuts you off so that you have to brake suddenly. Or then he passes you and then exits the freeway right in front of you. Now you see that over and over. You're throwing up your hands and saying, what was the point of that? Putting everybody's life at risk. Perhaps you've come across a mischief maker or a busybody. It could be a purse snatcher or a carjacker. Had one of those carjackers at my office in Los Angeles. We sent a girl to the bank with money. And she went there every afternoon. And she had made the deposit at the bank. Apparently the carjacker didn't plan it right because she had already dropped the bag off. And then he carjacked, God made her get out of the car and drove off with her car. So she was a little bit disgruntled by the whole affair when the guy has a gun pointed at the car and you decide the car isn't worth it and they can have it. So there could be a serious mischief maker or a life-threatening one. And the list could go on and on. If we sat down with our paper and pencil, we could probably come up with a lot more types of unjust people. The list is so long, and the lack of justice is so profound that the psalmist cried out to God for deliverance from the unjust man. And I'm going to go, whoops, I put that verse. I'm going to have to find it later and include it. And now I want to go through the, okay, I'll come up with it. I think it's Psalm 110, but I'll. And then there's a few famous, or infamous, I should say, unjust men in history. And this isn't in a particular order, but Pol Pot was a Cambodian dictator. He orchestrated the killing of about 7 million people during the forced depopulation of cities and the killing of anyone in the country who had any formal education. So all teachers, doctors, lawyers, any professional of any kind, professional clerks, were summarily executed. And entire cities were depopulated, means they marched them immediately, urban people off into the countryside, and with no luggage, no clothing, no food, no water, no anything, regardless of their age or infirmity. And if they didn't keep up with the march, they were shot. After many years, Pol Pot's government was overthrown. Years later, he was found in hiding. A book and a movie describes the horror of that time. The Killing Fields is the name of the book and the film. So Pol Pot, you could say, was one of the unjust men in history. Fidel Castro, who was a terrorist guerrilla leader, had been a Cuban dictator since 1959, and now that's over 50 years. He's now in his 80s. And under his rule, many people have been impoverished, suffered, or died under his rule. There's a fellow named Augusto Pinochet, who was the military dictator in Chile. He gained power in 1974 through his participation in the assassination of the previous leader, Allende. I know a little about that because my uncle-in-law was working for the CIA at the time under the guise of working for the State Department, and he was hands deep in that assassination as they changed out the government, and all they did was change from bad to other bad at that time. Under Pinochet's rule, 30,000 people have been documented to be tortured, 80,000 were imprisoned, an estimated 1,200 to 3,200 people were killed outright, and many people simply disappeared under his brutal rule. Eventually, he fled to Spain after many years, then fought extradition to Britain, and finally was sent back to Chile, where he died at age 91 in 1996. Then you may have heard of Mao Zedong, the communist dictator of China, born about the time of my grandfather in 1893, died in 76. So what would that make him, about 83? He's known to have killed 20 to 40 million of his own people, from the Chinese Revolution in 1949 to his death in 1976. Then there was Joseph Stalin, the communist dictator of the Soviet Union, killed also between 20 and 30 million of his own people under his rule. And then before that, there was the nomadic conqueror from Central Asia, Tamerlane. He was in the late 1200s AD, and he's known as the last nomadic conqueror, meaning they rode around on horses and chariots and wagons. He killed upwards of a million people, and his specialty was to chop off their heads. He was located north of Afghanistan in a country we now call Uzbekistan, and he would pile their heads up in pyramids. He liked the number 100,000, so he would go for 100,000 heads in a pyramid. 100,000 people died in Delhi, India, in 15 days because they weren't good enough Muslims. They were Muslim, and they weren't supposed to talk, but they were too tolerant of the Hindus. It took 100 years for for Delhi, India, to regrow its population because he had depopulated them so much. Another 100,000 died when Tamerlane conquered Baghdad, Iraq, and he made a pyramid of 100,000 heads in that area. He was trying then, he thought he would go conquer China, and he thought he would sneak into China in the back door, go over the mountains in January when they would never expect it, and caught pneumonia and died at age 71 trying to do the same thing in China. Of course, there are many more unjust men throughout mankind's history. In fact, that's the history of man, is unjust men being inhumane to other men. They took people's lives and property. They tortured and they maimed. They separated families and besmirched the innocent. And it doesn't seem as though those evil characters, and doesn't it seem like they tend to somehow live a long time. And Ecclesiastes 7:15 also calls that to mind. All the things and I have seen in the days of my vanity, there is a just man that perishes in his righteousness. And then there's the wicked man that prolongs his life in his wickedness. So sometimes it seems the wicked men in Ecclesiastes 7:15, they just seem to go, like the Energizer Bunny, they just seem to go on being wicked and killing the innocent. I do want to point out something from that verse, that there is a juxtaposition, two different things pointed out in that verse. On one side, you have the just man, and on the other side, it says you have the wicked man. So those are the opposites that are set up in that verse. So in one direction, you have the just, in the other direction, you have the wicked. But we've learned, I guess, that the way of man is the way of misery and death. And it's God's way that produces the good fruit, and it's Satan's way that produces the misery and the death. So now, those are just some examples of unjust men. I want to give a few examples, the biblical examples of what is a just man. After all, we're supposed to do justly, and these are people who are specifically mentioned in the Bible as being just men. And the first one I would call your attention to is in Genesis 6, verse 9. His name is Noah. In Genesis 6, verse 9, the first mention that I found, and there may be other words that could be translated right, but I just took the ones that said whoever was a just man. And Noah, it says in Genesis 6, verse 9, and these are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God. So the question is, what did Noah do to be called a just man? Well, the answer is right there. He walked with God. He obeyed God, and he did so despite the obstacles that lie before him. And there were many obstacles. He persevered in building the ark. If we were told to make our tools, make or obtain the tools that we needed, and go get the lumber by cutting down the trees, and you have to get the pitch. Now, where do you think they got the pitch from? The pitch didn't come in buckets from Lowe's or Home Depot. They had to catch the sap from the trees, make the pitch, and they had to create this. And they had 100 years to do it. And they were doing it not at Oceanside with rollers where they could roll the ark into the ocean like a shipbuilder would make it, or on a river where this would never clearly have enough support to it. They were doing it up on dry land. In other words, it was a public mockery that they were creating for themselves, Noah and his sons. They were subjecting themselves to a world that is even worse than today, if we can imagine. In many parts of this world, it's we're safe and secure here compared to many areas. And so they had to protect themselves, at the same time do the work that was required of them to build this ark for the salvation of themselves and life on the world as they knew it. And he had to keep the faith and not be that kind of a witness. And God called him a just man. Noah was a just man. And so it was a tremendous example of faith to follow God then in that wicked and turbulent society. The next mention that I find of a just man is in Matthew 1, verse 19. In Matthew 1, verse 19. And this is referring to Joseph, the husband of Mary. In Matthew 1:19, then Joseph, her husband, meaning Mary's husband, being a just man and not willing to make her a public example, was minded to put away her way privately. So what did Joseph do to be called a just man? Bearing in mind, we're all to do justly, and Joseph earned that title. He used wisdom and discretion in considering how to deal with a perplexing problem. During the period of his betrothal or engagement to Mary, his future bride, she turned up pregnant. Now, I dare say that that's a very difficult and awkward situation that not many people would handle well. Joseph practiced true respect and love by not desiring to make a public example out of the one chosen to be his future bride. Notice the very next verse, Matthew 1, verse 20. But while he, meaning Joseph, while he thought on these things, behold, the angel of the Eternal appeared to him in a dream, saying, Joseph, you son of David, fear not to take unto you Mary your wife, for that which is conceived in her is of the Holy Spirit. Joseph was not a man who was quick to anger. Why do you suppose he was selected to be the husband of Mary? The task before Joseph was great. He was to raise up a son unequaled in the history of mankind. In this case, a just man was slow to anger, he was careful, and he was loving. So we have the example of Noah, who walked with God, who kept the faith despite difficult circumstances. We have Joseph, who was slow to anger, who was careful and loving. He thought carefully before making that decision. The next example I came across was John the Baptist. We'll find him in Mark chapter 6 and verse 20. The next referral to a just man. And it's interesting here. I'm going to pull this verse out of the middle of this story and then go back and work this and explain the background. In Mark 6 and verse 20, for Herod feared John, knowing that he was a just man and holy, and observed him. And when he heard him, he did many things and heard him gladly. Now, interestingly enough, Mark 6 verse 20 is not about John the Baptist. It's actually about Jesus Christ, but at the time that described in this verse, John the Baptist had already died. He had been beheaded by King Herod. Herod knew that he had done wrong by having John the Baptist beheaded. Herod knew that John the Baptist was a just man. Hence, we read that in Mark 6 and verse 20. That Herod knew this. Now, how would he know that? I mean, you just don't see somebody off the street and say, there goes a just man. He had opportunity. He knew when what John the Baptist said to him was right. And if we go through the story, John the Baptist had denounced him for living with his brother's wife. And so now, if you read the earlier part of that chapter in Mark, King Herod was genuinely concerned that John the Baptist, because he was, as it says, a holy man and a just man, he was concerned that John the Baptist had risen from the dead. It was actually Christ, where all the people were around and were gathered around listening to him and were being healed by him. But he was so concerned that John the Baptist had risen from the dead, and now he was going to be afflicted by this terrible decision that he made. And for somebody who was either irreligious or superstitious or both, he had reason to be concerned. And so then it says Herod was then observing Christ and hearing him speak. So I'm wondering if there wasn't some family resemblance between the cousins, between John the Baptist and his cousin Jesus Christ, because King Herod knew John the Baptist face to face, and when he had him beheaded, he had the head brought right to him. And yet he looked at Christ and thought that was the reincarnation of John the Baptist. So even in any event, King Herod knew that a just man was before him, and that a just man was of God, who then that God could raise someone from the dead. Pretty profound in the thinking process there when he realized the potential for that. King Herod. Let's move down the page and we'll read verse 34. And this is what occurred following the death of John the Baptist in Mark 6 in verse 34. And Jesus, when he came out, saw so much people and was moved with compassion toward them because they were as sheep not having a shepherd, and he began to teach them many things. Now this happened right after the death of John the Baptist. And Christ saw what was happening, that the people were frustrated. They were confused as a sheep not having a shepherd. So if we understand now, as we read the death of John the Baptist, the people were as sheep with no shepherd. This tells us that this particular just man, John the Baptist, had the heart and the actions of a shepherd to help the people that he was sent to serve. Else, why would the people be as lost without their shepherd? The next person that I find in the Bible referred to as a just man is an unusual one that you would not expect to be there. The others all had some historical lineage, either with Christ or, as it were, coming along. This fellow was a Gentile. His name is Cornelius. In Acts 10, verse 22, we read, Cornelius in Acts 10, 22, we read, and they said, Cornelius the centurion, a just man, and one that fears God, and of good report among all of the nation of the Jews, was warned from God by a holy angel to send for you to his house and hear words of you. In other words, this is somebody who then, and Cornelius had asked for a visit from an apostle. And this was the report. And they, others, were calling him a just man. Now, often in the Bible, you will find the way to, as emphasizing something, they will say the same thing twice. First in one way, and then in another way, it will be a repeated item. In this case, so in other words, the same principle will be said two different ways. In this case, the term just man is immediately followed by two characteristics that describe a just man. So in that verse, we read, first of all, a just man and one that fears God. So one that fears God is a characteristic of a just man. If we take a look in 2 Samuel, in chapter 23 and verse 3, we find a similar literature example of something being said and then repeated, but it goes on to say what to point out what the point I want to make. In 2 Samuel 23 and verse 3, the God of Israel said, comma, the rock of Israel spoke to me. In other words, the God of Israel was the rock of Israel. Spoke to me, he that rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. So, these people were pointing to Cornelius and said, he's a just man, one that fears God. Do you suppose they understood the principle that to be a just man, if you are ruling over others, you must rule in the fear of God? That's precisely what they thought of Cornelius. Now, it's also in Job 28, verse 28, is the other part of that concept. In Job 28, verse 28, and unto man he said, behold, the fear of the eternal is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. So the reason that it's important for a ruler to fear God is because it's the wise thing to do, because that fearing God means that you will depart from evil. You're going to have understanding, and you will avoid the evil, and that means you're going to do right, do good. That will give you wisdom. So fearing God is the beginning of wisdom and understanding. Job 28, verse 28 is repeated almost word for word in Psalm 110, verse 10, and in Proverbs 9, verse 10. The other thing, the other characteristic that Cornelius had wasn't just fearing God, but interestingly enough, he had a good report among the Jews. And if you stop and think about it, this is really quite remarkable. Cornelius was an officer in a hated, occupying Roman army. And he had managed to develop a good rapport with the captured nation, with the Jews. So, understanding the underlying principle here, it's that it's important to have others give good report of you, even among those who would otherwise despise you. And certainly the Romans were despised by the Jews as an occupying force. And yet Cornelius had the character. He was doing things as a just man, avoiding evil, that and fearing God, that he generated such good feeling among the people that he was supposed to be ruling over as a centurion, as a in charge of 100 soldiers, that even those people were respecting him and saying that he was a just man. There's a third characteristic of Cornelius, and that is in the last part, and you look in the last part of Acts 10, verse 22, and the very last phrase, why was Cornelius calling for an apostle to come to him? It says, you know, he had called for someone to send for to come to his house to hear words of you. What did he really want here? The apostle, or to Cornelius, a just man, was willing to listen to the words sent by God. To hear the words of you, meaning as the apostle was speaking the words of God. Cornelius was searching that out. He was searching out that information. So those characteristics are fearing God, having a good report among others, and willing to listen to the words of God. Then we move down to verse 30 in Acts 10. And in Acts 10, and Cornelius said, 4 days ago I was fasting until this hour, and at the ninth hour I prayed in my house, and I'll just break it there. But there are, this lists two more characteristics of this just man, Cornelius. We read, he fasted and he prayed. So it's really quite a remarkable, all in just a matter of a few verses, that he feared God, had a good report among others, even those who would otherwise despise him, was willing to listen to the words of God. He fasted and he prayed. There is one other mention of a just man that I found in the Bible, and it's found in Matthew 27, verse 19. This is in the final hours of the physical life of Jesus Christ. He was hauled before Pontius Pilate for a court hearing. And Pilate was the prefect, the ruler of the province of Judea under the Roman emperor. Pilate reported to his boss Caesar, Emperor Tiberius. And as such, Pilate had a job that was political, a political hot potato. He had to keep the peace in his corner of the Roman Empire so he could extract as much tax as he could out of the people. And Matthew 27, verse 19, when he, Pontius Pilate, was set down on the judgment seat, in other words, ready to make a ruling in a matter, his wife sent to him saying, "Have you nothing to do with that just man?" And the person before him, of course, was Jesus Christ in the few hours before Christ's death. "What does she say? For I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him." She was very concerned that her husband would be involved in anything bad that happened to someone, the wife of the prefect called a just man. She recognized it. This was not in a vacuum. So it was Pilate's wife who pointed out that Christ was a just man. Pilate shouldn't have anything to do with Christ. She was fearful of what was going to happen. And then we read later that Pilate washed his hands in public to demonstrate an attempt to be guiltless in the pending death of Jesus Christ. So now we've covered the examples of the unjust men and we examples of the just men in the Bible. There's a few other characteristics that the Bible talks about, of characteristics of what it takes to do justly. First, in the extra list that I have, it says, be willing to learn, number one. In Proverbs 9:9, give instruction to a wise man, and he will yet be wiser. Teach a just man, and he will increase in his learning. So a characteristic of a just man is that he will increase in his learning because he's willing to learn. He's willing to accept instruction. A person who knows it all cannot be taught. So we must be willing to learn in order to practice doing justly. The second principle we find, not tied to any one person, be honest in our dealings. In Proverbs 20, verse 7, the just man walks in his integrity. His children are blessed after him. Perhaps you've seen the old Norman Rockwell painting of a small town meat market where the seemingly happy butcher has his thumb on the scale when he weighs out the meat that he is selling. Well, we've all been cheated a time or two in our life, and we use these experiences to teach our children and grandchildren how much better God's way of life is, where people can deal openly and honestly without fear of being ripped off. So number two is be honest in our dealings. Third is keep trying. In Proverbs 24, verse 16, for a just man falls seven times and rises up again, but the wicked shall fall into mischief. In other words, the just man, even though, will fall. And it says here, in other words, bad things are going to happen. That's the nature of living this life. The just man keeps rising up again. When they say seven, I think earlier we've heard the reference to how many times we should forgive our brother. Is it seven times? Or is it, and Christ said 70 times seven, which is metaphorical for meaning there isn't a limit. Similarly here, we must keep trying. How many times in life, I look at myself, have I wanted to give up? How many times in life did I think that the task at hand was hopeless? How many times did I said to myself, it's just too tough? However, we should take comfort in that we will not be handed a greater burden than we are able to carry. I'm just going to reference it, 1 Corinthians 10:1. About no temptation greater than what you can bear without a way to escape. And earlier we read in Proverbs 29, verse 27, an unjust man is an abomination to the just. Well, it's terrible to have to deal with somebody who is unjust. And here's my psalm. The psalmist shows it's possible to get relief. In Psalm 43, verse 1, judge me, O God, and plead my cause against an ungodly nation. Deliver me from the deceitful and unjust man. Now, why would the psalmist say that, pleading and asking to be delivered from the deceitful and unjust man. You see, if it were not possible to obtain relief from the unjust man, then any pleading prayer to God would be in vain. It would be fruitless. We may as well throw up our hands, give up, eat worms, and die. But it's possible to obtain relief. The psalmist knew that relief was possible, and that's why he sought God's help. So we have the advantage of the writings of the apostles to make clear our Christian way. And, of course, we're familiar with John 14:14. If you ask anything in my name, I will do it. And we may have heard messages that's also conditioned by us doing our part and asking rightly. And the verse immediately following that in John 14:15, if you love me, keep my commandments. So in other words, you ask, but just keep reading here. In other words, it's conditioned by you can't expect good things to happen if you keep doing things that you shouldn't. There's a vivid example of someone who did not throw up her hands and quit when she came upon an unjust man. I'm not going to read through it, this particular parable, but the parable is often entitled The Importunate Widow, or it's called The Parable of the Unjust Judge. It's in Luke 18, and really is only the first 8 verses. But in this case, a widow, which was a very low status in power in society, in fact, many societies around the world even today, which is why in Deuteronomy 24, widows were specifically provided for in the Hebrew nation by leaving the corners of the fields and the vineyards gleaning so the widows could harvest crops. As for Ruth and Naomi, made their subsistence. But the unjust judge in this parable in Luke, he knew he didn't have to hear the widow's complaint because she didn't have anywhere else to go. He had the power and she did not. Well, just as God provided, but she was persistent. And she kept trying. She kept at it because she was being wronged by some unjust person who was besieging her, and the judge was unjust. And yet, so finally, the judge just came up, and sure enough, just as God said, he would provide a way to overcome the injustice. We can also follow that widow's example. Ask repeatedly if we must, and then have faith in God and his ways. During this message, I've referred to Proverbs 29, verse 27 a couple of times, but only looked at the first half of that verse. I want to look at the last half of that verse now. In Proverbs 29, verse 27, and the verse reads like this, "An unjust man is an abomination to the just. He that is upright in the way is an abomination to the wicked." Well, of course, we know an unjust man is an abomination to the just because we have all been on the receiving end of somebody who's done something wrong, bad, unjust to us. And it's really painful when we're on the receiving end of it. But and then the last half of the verse, "He that is upright in the way is an abomination to the wicked." Well, how in the world could that be? When you're doing the right thing, have you noticed that sometimes it irritates those people who want to do the wrong thing? It can start on the schoolyard as you are a youngster. What if Johnny comes to you and says, "Hey, a bunch of us are skipping school today. Bobby's got a six-pack. Davey's bringing some weed. We can ride in Freddie's car. His license was suspended, but he can still drive his old man's car. Let's go." Well, when you decline the invite to do wrong, it can be dramatic like that, or it could be subtle. Those who invited you to do the wrong may turn on you and mock you. What's the matter? Are you a pansy? Are you afraid of getting caught? You're just a chicken. Bark, 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 bark. We've all heard the kind of teasing that happens. What about in the workplace where we suffer accordingly? An abomination to the person who's upright is an abomination to the wicked. when somebody else is taking things from the workplace that they shouldn't and they offer some of it to you, whether it's lots of pencils and pens or whatever it happens to be, they don't care. No big deal. Here, have some. And you say, "No, I don't think so." Do they not like it that you didn't participate in what they were doing? These are pressures that our children, grandchildren, and co-workers' families face every day. The peer pressure is strong. And as we read in the last half of that verse, in Proverbs 29:27, it's sometimes hard to do the right thing under the face of pressure of people who abhor God's laws. Of course, we all have perhaps heard stories or experienced that, whether it's family or neighbors, when we started keeping the Sabbath, all of a sudden they, rarely whoever went to church on Sunday, all of a sudden they're going every week just because they can't stand the thought of just the implication that you're doing what you should, therefore they have to go and show how different it is. And I think we've all seen some of that. Okay, I've got through the first point. Okay, and that is to do justly. And as I promised you, the other ones will go very quickly. The second one is to love mercy. Each one of these, you see, is a separate message. And I thought about doing that. But by the time we got through all three, we'd be strung out for so many months that we would have been disjointed and disconnected. So I'm just going to give you some a slight reference here. On Micah 6:8, it called for us to do justly. And the second thing it says was to love mercy. I'm going to point to a parable and in Matthew 18, starting in verse 23, and it runs through verse 35. And this is the parable that is focusing on the aspect of mercy and forgiveness about a king who was taking account of his servants, starts in verse 23, and that the servant was not paying the king what he should, what he owed him, and so therefore the king told the servant that he was be sold into servitude along with his wife and his children, all he had. In other words, he was bankrupt and that he would have to turn everything over to his major creditor. And the man pleaded with the king and says, no, don't do this. I'll pay you. Give me time. Give me just a little more patience here and we'll do this. And the king says, okay, fine. I'll do that. And then that servant who owed a lot of money to the king went out and did a shakedown on the people that owed him money. He was desperate to collect and he was not very merciful or forgiving, even though the king had forgiven him. And had applied mercy to him, he did not apply the mercy to others who owed him far less by comparison. So if we really thought long and hard about applying the parable, we would realize how difficult it is to have mercy on those who have done serious wrong to us. Yet we're called to temper justice because, it's just not right. They ought to get what's coming to them, right? But if we temper justice with mercy, in Psalm 89, verse 14, justice and judgment are the habitation of your throne. That's the first half of that verse. In Psalm 89:14, justice and judgment are the habitation of your throne. That's the rule of the day. Those are the expectations. God's laws are there. And then the second half of that verse is, mercy and truth shall go before your face. In other words, they came together. Just like they were together in Micah 6:8, they're together in Psalm 89:14, where you have justice and judgment followed immediately by mercy and truth. In other words, it must be tempered together. So these things, justice and mercy, go hand in hand. now, of course, some people take this admonition to extend mercy to the absurd extreme. And, of course, you want to notice the order of the principles in Micah 6:8. Justice comes first and then the mercy. We don't read in the Bible that we just forego justice altogether and then simply hand out get out of jail free cards. Satan would like us to go to that extreme. And such a libertine attitude then would endorse an anything goes society. And that's not beholden to any laws. So if there's no laws, there's no justice. For it's because justice is the carrying out of the law. So that mercy is a very precious commodity. It's carefully granted. And as it says in Micah 6:8, it doesn't say we're to always grant the mercy, but we are to love the mercy and then be careful. Because love is a pretty strong word if we are to love mercies. In other words, we're to look for ways to extend mercy in such a manner that it will help the person receiving the mercy. Not just mercy that will result in more bad behavior. Well, I'll let it go this time as the thief stole from the store, and pretty soon they're stealing more and more and more. And it does them no favor. It's not merciful to let someone off the hook just in the name of mercy. Do we let a serial killer go free to kill again? No, I don't think so. That would not be merciful to his future victims. the third point In Micah 6:8, walk humbly with your God. And, of course, that's the third one. It's in order. After we've do justly, and we focused on that today, we've called attention to loving mercy, then it says walk humbly with your God. And I want to call attention to, first of all, we read earlier in Isaiah about the importance of holiness, that setting apart of God for a special purpose. In order for us to be then at one with God, to be truly holy, we must be humble. And I'd like to call your attention to the parable in Luke 18, and it's in verses 9 through 14. I'm only going to paraphrase it. I will speak on the first sentence in Luke 18, verse 9. And he spoke this parable, meaning Christ did, unto certain which trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. And then they go through the list of all of the things. They're very righteous, and they do all of these things, and how righteous they are, and they fast, they give tithes, and they thank God that they're not like all those other sinners out there. So if someone does justly and loves mercy and then brags about it, makes a big show, don't they really miss the point? Is calling attention to how often we fast or pray or how righteous we are, is that a loving, respectful thing to do? Makes me think of 1 Corinthians 13:1. You don't need to turn there. We have a song about that. It's called the Love Chapter. Though I speak with tongues of men and angels, if I have not charity, I'm become as a sounding brass or tinkling cymbal. In other words, if we're tooting our horn as to how righteous we are or how humble we are, then the verse says we're just making noise. So if we look at the order of things here, we have do justly, love mercy, walk humbly with our God. Even so, people somehow misconstrue God's instructions in all three areas of this instruction. Notice the verse says what is required of us in Micah 6:8. It doesn't say suggest or recommend or ask us to consider. It's an imperative. We must. These three points are expected of us. And fortunately, like all of God's instructions, they are for our lasting benefit. Sometimes we read over Bible verses, we're quick to apply the verses to someone else. That God says to do justly, so therefore we immediately project that on others, and we expect them to do justly to us, especially to us. I mean, not that they do justly, but they especially to us. The commandments actually doesn't say that. It says for us to do justly to others. It doesn't mean that others will always reciprocate. They will always not do the thing back. In fact, our life experience has taught us that doing justly is the exception instead of the rule, that we humans often expect justice of others without necessarily doing so well at it ourselves. God expects us to do justly, but in a balanced way, balanced with mercy. A little over a week ago, as I've mentioned in the announcements, a dear old friend died. Leonard Scriber was once my minister almost 30 years ago. And I remember the first year that he was at the Feast of Tabernacles. He was at the coordinator in Eugene, Oregon. I was working on the 24-hour communications teams that they had at large feast sites at that time. So I was at an early planning meeting for the feast. And Mr. Scriber made it clear to all the department heads and all the other volunteers that their job was to make their job look easy. He said if we were all relaxed and approached every situation in a calm and deliberate manner, then that calm, easygoing example would ripple across the feast, radiating a good sense of comfort. He demonstrated the importance of being humble servants by his own actions. If somebody made a mistake, and mistakes are happen, he allowed them to correct it without making a big deal about it. I will long remember Leonard Scriber as a man who practiced Micah 6:8. Well, today we looked at the 8th century B.C. history around the time of the prophets, Isaiah, Hosea, Amos, and Micah. We saw how Micah focused together the principles spoken of by those other prophets. We looked at the examples of unjust people in our everyday lives. We've had a brief overview of some of the most unjust men on earth. We reviewed the lives of the people mentioned in the Bible as being just men and why they were considered just. And we looked at a few more scriptures to get a more complete understanding of what it takes to be a just man. we explored the biblical teaching of mercy, and we saw that justice tempered with mercy must be accompanied by humility in our walk with God. So what does the Eternal require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, and walk humbly with your God?